Okay, never mind. Say your name, you probably have issues. Does anyone have any issues with this flag? Yeah.
So, whenever we have to get the angle,
we may come back to it with some examples in a minute anyway, but the question was, when you're figuring out angles, when you're breaking vectors into components, does it matter whether you do, 60 degrees or greater than 60 minus 60, 300 degrees? I think mentally it is difficult to get that right, and you sometimes run the risk, particularly with tangents, that you can get some quadrant sign errors and stuff. So mentally, what I always do is make sure that I'm basically doing components within the 90 degrees. I find that is much better. Yes, you can do the big angle, and often I think it will work out with the signs as IBMs correctly, but not always. I think you have to be a little bit careful.
Anything else? Okay, so I would like to start today with a demonstration of sorts. And so what I have here is fancy technical equipment. I have just a rope, and I have attached to this rope, conveniently placed so that many of you cannot see the bottom of it. At the bottom I have a mass, a steel ball. A little ways up I have a mass. There's two steel balls, but don't worry about the difference in mass if there is one. Then a little ways further up, I have two steel balls. And then over here, I have three balls, but just so you can see sort of this distance is shorter than that distance, which is shorter than that distance, okay? And down here, I have basically a big metal lid so that when the balls hit the lid, they make the sound. Okay? And now I want you to just pay attention to what you see in here when I do the big exciting thing here. Ready? That was exciting. All right. Because apparently everyone's so thrilled, we're going to try that again. Okay, what'd you hear? Is there something you can observe about what you heard? Apparently not. Yes, what did you hear? Okay. Well, let's try this again and see if we all agree. Okay, pay attention to the interval of time between the sounds that you hear. Progressively longer. The same, roughly.
Thank you.
many of you think it was progressively longer? How many of you think it was the same, roughly? Okay. So it's not perfect. Why do you think it was whatever you heard? I mean, you heard what you heard. Granted, can you motivate, can you explain why it is that it is what we heard? If you look at this, if you heard it progressively get longer, why do you think that is so? The distance increases between each interval, so therefore you would expect it to take longer for the successive balls to hit, would be the logic. If you heard the intervals be approximately the same, why do you think that might be so? What do you think? Okay, gravity is constant as a force, which means you have a constant acceleration on these things. Which means that the balls up there are going progressively faster and faster by the time they hit this thing. Okay. Than these balls, right? They also are accelerating, but because they go less of a distance, their average velocity over the entire fall is going to be less. So you can calculate the time of fall for these different balls, and in fact, you'll find that if you place them correctly, you'll actually hit approximately the same time interval, in spite of the fact that these lengths are much greater. Yes?
Does it make any difference that after one ball drops, the weight is going to be less?
That's a fabulous question. So the idea is those balls are being pulled down by the weight of all of these balls plus the rope. And then when this ball is now on the ground, you have less weight, less mass effectively pulling it down. And what we'll find is that the force on those balls and the upper is greater when you have all this stuff holding them. But the acceleration in the gravity doesn't care what the mass is. So one of the demos we'll do, hopefully I'll remember to do it actually next class. We'll take a feather and a penny, and I'll put it in an evacuated tube, and you'll see that they fall at the same rate. You don't think of it that way. A feather's light falls, but it's the air friction that keeps it from falling. Mass, so the acceleration due to gravity is independent of the mass of the object. But we'll talk a whole lot about that soon. Okay, so I agree that it's clearly an imperfect demo, and I have done it in the past where it was a little more obvious, but what you were supposed to hear was that the intervals were approximately the same. If you heard them get it for a little longer, I think maybe they did a little bit too, so. Okay. It is an experimental science. If you've done any of that, you understand it doesn't always work plainly. All right, so last time we were talking a lot about vectors. And we looked at how they add vectors together graphically. We looked at how they add them together analytically. And In order to add vectors together analytically, or to do any problem that involves vectors generally, often, unless it's a one-dimensional thing, and of course you really need vectors only for multi-dimensional things, you very often will have to break them into components.
And so if we have some vector b here and some angle theta that is defined here, this vector b can be thought of as the sum of by plus this bx that you can barely see because it's an F6 sort of green, okay? You know, this is a broadly educational institution, so I'm going to give you a hint here. If you ever do anything with PowerPoint or whatever, never use light green. I'm serious. If you ever give a talk at a conference or something, you'll have this beautiful light green. All your slides will look absolutely fabulous, and you'll be in the middle of your talk, and you'll look up, and half the crap on your slides is completely invisible. It's the one color to avoid. If you're going to use green at all, you need to always use dark green. Okay, so clearly I don't listen to my own self. This is an arrow that actually is the same as this one. It is this vector moved up. And when you think about adding vectors, mentally, I like to think of them this way. But the moment that I break them into components and want to think of them as being the component along x and the component along y, I like to think of them this way. They're completely equivalent because this vector is the same as that vector. This is how you think about it when you think about adding them together, and then you want to translate it down here because that's how you think about it when you want to think about components along the axis. So it's just a little mental game. They're both equivalent. Having said that, if we have this vector b, what you want to do is define these components, and you can do that by the directions of those two component vectors specified by what your axes are, really. And mentally, you look and figure out whether this is pointed in the negative direction or the positive direction. You don't need to worry about that, because you can look at it and see, and you have to keep that sign, S-I-B-N, straight when you're doing the one-dimensional piece. But what you can get with breaking things into components using these trigonometric rules is to think of this as a triangle, and you can get the relative magnitudes of these with respect to b. So b and the y, being the adjacent vector here, is going to be the magnitude of this b times the cosine of that angle. Cosine because it's the adjacent. And this being the x, be careful, if you write it this way, you may think of it as an adjacent. But it's not, because when you're doing the angles, you write it this way, which means you have to mentally think of it as over here. And then it's the opposite. So you get the magnitude as b sine theta. All right, get really, really good at that, or it will bite you at the most inconvenient times. Okay? And we call this, you know, resolving the vector often. Okay, so let us practice this for a moment. We have a vector, v. Okay? And I would like to know what is the horizontal component of this velocity if this magnitude is 3 and this angle is 55. And you have four answers here. Take just a moment, look at them. Decide which one you believe is the best answer for the horizontal component of velocity. Fix the Roman numeral in your mind. Close your eyes. Who thinks it's 1? Who thinks it's 2? Who thinks it's 3? Who thinks it's 4? Alright, so I think we had most hands go up for this, but it was not an overwhelming fraction of the class. If I asked who didn't want to raise their hand, I think we might have gotten the overwhelming fraction of the class. There were a couple of hands that went up over here. The way to do this is the horizontal component is going to be the piece that points in that direction. Right? So it would be, here's the vertical piece, here's the horizontal piece, so it's the opposite of the 55, so you take the magnitude of this 3 times the sine of 55 because it's opposite. So I would choose this one as the, and note that I asked component of the velocity, so it's a vector, which means you have to specify the direction. Okay? Let's do one that's a little dicier.
We have a ball that is, let's say, we're not going to worry about rolling or friction or anything like that. We'll do that later. Let's suppose it's a greased inclined plane, and this ball just whoosh down the inclined plane at 3 meters per second. So its velocity vector here is parallel to that inclined plane. And let's say that inclined plane, the incline is at an angle of 50 degrees with the horizontal. So what I would like to know is, what is the speed with which the ball drops toward the ground? Do you think it's one? How many of you think it's two? How many of you think it's three? How many of you think it's four? Alright, so let's think about this for a second. In order to do this, I ask, what is the speed with which it drops toward the ground? So what I really want to know in order to get the speed is I need to determine the magnitude of the component of the velocity that is straight down. As it goes down the inclined plane, I want to think, what is the component that goes straight to the ground? Because that tells you the speed with which it closes toward the ground. So then the trick with these is actually making sure you get the angles right as you look in components. So this component, which is the one you want straight down, is not bigger than the other. Is this component. And it may be a little... There are different ways you can figure out how the angles work, but the way I think about it is just as if you imagine this inclined plane is on a hinge here, as it closes, this downward vector will close up to this horizontal line that's at right angles to this line. So as this opens up, this angle opens up, which means this 50 degrees corresponds to 50 degrees here. This is a 90 degree angle, which means this is a 30 degree angle, which means as I look at components, this one is the 50 degree angle, which means this, the magnitude of this is going to be the magnitude of that times the sine of 50 degrees, which is number 3. Okay, so that's how I think that. And there are other ways. We'll talk more when we get to inclined planes about that kind of angle. But the kind of thing that is most commonly missed on exams when it comes to inclined plane things is choosing that angle incorrectly. That's usually the trickier part.
Can you explain that again?
It's a little hard to imagine. Here's my vector that goes straight down, okay? And here's the inclined plane. As this angle opens up, this vector stays going down, okay? If this is a nail that is put in at right angles, as the angle opens up, that nail also moves, which means its angle with respect to straight down opens up in the same way, so they're equivalent. It's a silly mental game that I don't know what the pedagogical use of it is, but it's what I do. So I will usually tell you how I do it first, there are other ways to do it, and when we get to inclined planes and do it, there are ways to do it with trigonometric lines and stuff, actual rules that you learn. And so we'll do it both ways. And what I have found is that I've known students who really like it one way and totally don't really get the other way, and vice versa. And anecdotally, I find it breaks down about 50-50, so we'll look at it both ways. Okay. So really the point of this one is maybe get us started thinking about inclined planes a little bit, but the real point is that sometimes it is not really trivial. You have to think your way through these lines and sometimes redraw little vectors and stuff to make sure you have the geometry right. So whatever you do, and it depends very much on which angle is given to you. So whatever you do, do not fall into the habit of just memorizing, oh, it's this type of problem, so it's a sine theta. You really, every time, have to go through and do this mental trick. It's okay to keep in mind, I thought it was a sine theta, but make sure you confirm it every time, okay? Because sometimes the angle that you're given may be a different one, and it may throw you for a loop if you don't do it right. Okay, so why it's so important that we break vectors into components is that along a single direction, you can really think of vectors as numbers with an algebraic sign where one of them goes this way as a positive sign, one of them goes that way as a negative sign, and it's easy to add them together. You can do that mentally. Then you get a vector along that direction, and you can recombine it with whatever the resolved components are along each of the other directions to get sort of the three-dimensional thing. So in the three-dimensional world, we really work with vectors, and you can imagine something at any position that you'd like. You can describe it at, remember that position is a three-point in free space, and you can describe that as a vector that starts at the origin and goes to whatever the x, y, z is. But think, if this object is moving, this vector changes length and direction with it. So this vector is a function of time, if you will. And it has, each vector has an x component, y component, and a z component carefully disguised in terms of this I hat, j hat, and k hat. Remember that I hat is a unit vector in the x direction. So it is a vector with magnitude 1, so that when you do a calculation, the magnitude doesn't play a role, only the direction plays a role. So this is a way of writing that vector. These will all be functions of time. Not the unit vectors, but the s's will be. I don't put arrows over these little x's, s's, because these are just magnitudes. The direction is given by the unit vectors. I take the derivative of this with respect to time, and I have the velocity vector. And it is changing. It can change arbitrarily, but it is always the derivative of the position vector. The derivative of that, and this you can call dsx dt, or you can call it the x component of velocity, dx. Take the derivative of that. That is the second derivative of this vector, or the single derivative of that vector, and you get the acceleration vector, which again could change arbitrarily depending on what the problem is and you know what the forces are on this thing. So very generally, you have this object going through, and as a function of time, it has a position, velocity, and acceleration vectors that may change over time. So that can be arbitrarily hard if you want to think of it that way, but. Okay, now I want to do another demo for you. In this demo, I have two balls, and I will not stop my sentence there. I have two balls. Actually, I was doing a similar sort of thing. And I was showing the demo, and I got distracted, right, because I saw something I had to fix, and so I explained that I had two balls, and then I started messing up this, and all of a sudden the class started laughing. Oh, okay.
The demo has two balls. Here's one, here's one. And the way this is set up is I have this spring-loaded thing such that when I flick this lever up, the spring will push the lever like that. When it does, this ball will slip off. It will just simply drop, okay? Because it just slides off this thing. This ball is going to get hit like a pool cue or something on it. It's going to get launched. Okay? So, the ball to the left just drops. The ball to the right starts out going straight this way. Okay? And they both fall to the ground. And they start at the same time, effectively. Alright? So then the question that I have for you is, does one hit the ground first? Does two hit the ground first? Or do they hit at the same time? Who thinks it's one? Who thinks it's two? Who thinks it's three? Why are we doing this demo? Alright, let's just prove it. Physics works on every other demo. Thank you. Okay. And the reason that it does that is because the motion in the two dimensions really is independent. So even though this ball started going that way, it had force down, the same as the force down on the other ball, so their motion starting from the same point at the same time is identical in that dimension. This dimension being independent of it. Okay? So good. Since you guys all have no trouble with that kind of thing, I'm going to have to work extra special on exam one to make it challenging. Just kidding. All right. So, if you're near the surface of the Earth, the force is the same at every point in the motion downward. So you have an acceleration. This A of T is basically constant, which is why the motion up and down is the same for those two balls. And what that means, though, you'll note that there's no acceleration component this way. So as we saw last time, what you'll see is that the velocity vectors evolve accordingly, which is the velocity vectors along the y have to change because you have acceleration in the y, and the velocity vectors in the x do not change because you have no acceleration in the x. So, I have a cool applet to show you, which shows these vectors as a function of time. And one of the things I wanted to do was to do those lines. Okay, so if you'll note in this motion, so every certain time interval, you'll draw these lines. And what you'll note is that the spacing between these lines is the same, which means the velocity of the ball in the horizontal direction is the same at all points. Up and down, you'll note that the velocity, that the distance it goes in each interval is smaller and smaller up until you get to the very top where it basically doesn't go between intervals. And then that interval begins to grow again as the velocity becomes larger and negative. I do not know why. Oh. Yeah, you can play games with this. So as you're thinking about three-dimensional motion, sometimes it's nice to have this kind of thing right in your head. Note though, although
Note that the range does change, because depending on how high it goes, that changes the amount of time that's in the air. It's moving to the right for however much that time is. So if you have maximal time in the air, you'll get maximal range. And it's not completely obvious what the answer to that is in terms of what angle to choose. Because if you choose an angle that is straight up, you will kick the thing up higher, but you will have a smaller horizontal velocity. So although it goes higher and it's in the air longer, the horizontal velocity is smaller, so it actually doesn't go as far. As you bring that angle down, it's in the air less time, but the horizontal velocity is bigger. So you have to actually do a calculation and juggle those two against each other to figure out what the maximum range is. I think it's done as an example in your book, but it's not really so obvious. Any issues, questions with this one? All right, so there's a link on the website that has this if you want to play with it. Very good fodder for parties, trust me. I do it all the time. Two bottles of wine, then you pull out the projectile motion. It's good. Okay. You know, the sad truth is there are certain dinner parties I'd probably go to where that would work. Okay, so what I want to do now is to show you, let's do an example problem that involves projectile motion. So it's now, we're going to be doing a multi-dimensional problem. So in this problem, let us suppose that we are having a picnic. Okay, and the most horrible thing that happens at picnics is going to happen. So we have a bird flying at 5 meters per second, and it will go directly over the table. And we're going to say that this bird is 10 meters in the air, and the bird does what birds do when the bird is a distance of 15 meters from the edge of the table, and we're going to say that the table itself is 1 meter wide, and then the question is, you know, does the bird ruin the picnic? All right? So that's the issue. So now we have a projectile that starts right here. And what is the initial velocity of that?
5 meters per second?
Yeah, I mean, it's moving with the bird, and the moment it's released, it is moving at 5 meters per second horizontally. There is no vertical component the way this one is set up. I could have the bird moving at an angle or something like that to make it a bit harder, but yeah. Yes, we do. We need the height of the table, and we're going to assume that we're on level ground here. The height of this, I think I said, was 1 meter. All right. So the way to do this is you think, well, you have to think of it about in the x and y directions. So one of the things you need to do is you need to figure out, you've got to define directions, and you've got to define sort of your coordinate system. And then having done that, you have to be consistent for the rest of the problem. So in this case, let's see what I want to choose. I'll go ahead and choose this point as sort of my origin, 0, 0. And I will call this as my plus y direction, I'll call this as my plus x direction. There is no religion about whether this is plus y or minus y. It does not matter. But once you've defined it, you have to look at every vector in that direction and give it an algebraic sign accordingly. So what that means is that if I decide this is positive y, then I know I have an acceleration down toward the center of the Earth that's equal to the size of g, okay? And in this problem, when I do the y equations, it has to come in with a minus sign because it is opposite the positive definition of the direction of y. So, in the y direction, I know that I have a constant acceleration a, which is minus 9.8 meters per second. In the y direction, when the payload is released, right, there is no vertical component, so I know v0y is equal to zero. And if I want to know, what I'd like to know to do this problem is I will have a horizontal velocity component, which in fact will be 5 meters per second because there's no acceleration in the horizontal direction. So the question is, how far this goes is determined by how long it's in the air. And what you want to know is, how far does it go in the time that the vertical component goes from here down to the height of the table? Okay? So if it goes between 15 and 16 meters, then you've ruined the picnic. If it goes less or further, you're safe. Well, unless you're sitting here, but we're going to ignore that. Okay? So V0... we know that y0, that is the initial y position, the way we've defined it is a plus 10 meters. And the final y, really, we want to know how long it takes to fall to y equal 1 meter. And along the x direction, we know a in the x is equal to 0. V0 in the x is equal to 5 meters per second. X0 is equal to 0. And x is what we want to find. Okay? Individual dimension, we can use our one-dimensional constant acceleration equation because we have shown that acceleration is constant. But always ask yourself that, because if it's not constant and you pull out those equations, they don't work. Right? So always sort of ask yourself, are they constant before you pull one of them out? And then you play with whatever the four of them are to get the one that you think will work. In this case, y is equal to y0 plus b0 in the yt plus 1/2 at squared works. Y being 1 meter, y0 being 10 meters, b0y is 0 minus 1/2 9.8 meters per second squared times t squared. And you find that t, when you solve for t, is 1.4 seconds. So then you ask, how far does the projectile go in 1.4 seconds? So if we go over to the x place, x is equal to x naught plus v0 xt plus 1/2 a in the xt squared, or x minus x naught, well, x naught is 0, so x is equal to 5 meters per second, which is the v0, times t, and you want to put in 1.4 seconds because that's this piece, and that is equal to 7 meters. So in fact, you're safe. Actually, you end up with something that goes about like that in this problem. Okay? A little anticlimactic. Any questions? So, if I were to do something a little harder, I'm pretty sure I've done this before on the test, where it's basically the same problem. You have a jet with a bomb or something, and now it's actually traveling at 20 degrees below horizontal when it releases the bomb or whatever. Okay? Then you have an initial velocity vector that actually has an angle. You have to break it into components. Once you have that into components, you have the same problem we just did, except the V0 horizontal is not zero. There were a couple of questions. Yes?
Can you move the slide down?
Yes.
So you can see the bottom of the
video. I can't do that. Is there another question, or was that the same?
Same thing, okay. Systematically go through what are called Newton's three laws shortly, and that will govern much of what you do through the whole semester in terms of problems. But I sort of want to short circuit that a little bit and talk about, because we've been talking about gravity at the surface of the Earth quite a bit, so let me sort of just go through that a little bit for you. There is a law that we'll get to. I guess I'll go ahead and show you this. Okay, so we're going to get into Newton's laws, okay? And here's the dude himself. And his second law basically says that the sum of the vectors on an object, the vector forces, is equal to the mass times the vector acceleration. Okay, so we call that Newton's second law. And I want to look at that at the surface of the Earth to sort of put a little flesh around the bones of what we've been talking about in terms of the force of gravitation. So if we look at... So what it says is the sum of the forces is equal to the mass times the acceleration. And it's not crazy. If you can imagine this football season, right? If you can imagine a collision between two football players, right? So you have some skinny guy like me, and you have a big linebacker hitting me, right? As the linebacker exerts a force on me, I'm going to accelerate, right? If I'm heavier, I accelerate less. So there's this inverse proportionality. Depending on how much force I exert, I get a lot of acceleration. If I put the force this way, I accelerate that way. So it's really just intuitive, right? If I would get hit hard by one linebacker coming this way and one linebacker coming that way simultaneously, before I go to the hospital, I will be accelerated this way by that guy, this way by that guy, combined vectorially, which means I do my face plant that way, right? It's a vector sum thing. Okay. So, there are, as it turns out,
lots of forces to consider in nature. In this class, we will be considering many different forces that are sort of everyday life forces that you're used to. Springs, gravitation, force of friction. These are things you encounter in everyday life. In Physics 114, you will talk about, most of the semester, you'll talk about something known as the force of electromagnetism. It turns out, So, most forces that you think of in your everyday life actually can be thought of at the most fundamental level as either being due to gravity or the force of electromagnetism in some form. And the way to think about that force of electromagnetism thing is anything chemical actually involves nuclei and electrons, basically. And so it really boils down to electromagnetism in the end. There are two other forces in nature, and I spend a lot of my time playing with those. One's called the strong nuclear force, which holds protons and neutrons together, basically, and nuclei together. And the other is called the weak nuclear force, which the place where you're most likely to run into it would be in beta decay, so radioactive decay in the lab, that kind of thing. It turns out that these forces are essentially important for generating the power that's in the center of stars, or nuclear power, and things like that. So it's not as if it's irrelevant to your life. In fact, it's essential for your life, but you don't run into it every day. But gravitation and electromagnetism largely completely dominate your day. You know, why is it a pain to go upstairs if you're carrying a big bag of books, or etc. So
these are fundamental forces. Now, Newton came up with a law of gravity, which, I mean, he certainly stood on the shoulders of some others, but he basically inferred from watching things, and you can actually go out and empirically look at this in the lab. If you have two objects which have mass, so mass 1 and mass 2, they could have arbitrary shapes or whatever. We'll worry about fine points like what you would consider to be the center of these objects in terms of their mass distribution later. But let us suppose that they are sort of point-like, so we don't have to worry about that. And we have a distance between them, which is given by R. Then it turns out that there is a force between these objects, which for objects in everyday life, you really don't notice it because it's a very small force. But when the objects become very big, or there's no other forces around, it dominates. It's the big thing. And in our case, it's so important if one of those objects happens to be the Earth, because the Earth is so big, it has such a huge mass, the force on us is actually quite noticeable. But this law says that the force between these two objects goes as a big G times M1 times M2 over R squared. Now, there are lots of reasons why we have to put this G here, because it's really neat and easy to confuse it with the other G that we're about to talk about. But you'll note this is a big G. And what is its function? What we're saying is that this force, whatever it is, a priori, depends on the size, how much mass you have here, the distance between them. So as this grows, the force drops off as a square. And once I decide what units I want to measure force in, so in NKS units we call it the Newton, I have to put in a constant here that gives me the correct number of Newtons if I measure this in kilograms, that in kilograms, and that in meters squared. It sort of sets, it gives you the correct number for whatever units you choose. So that's what you have to have a constant for.
And in a sense, you can think of that constant as quantifying the strength of the force. If I wanted to, you know, fundamentally double the strength of electromagnetism, I mean, gravitation, I could say, you know, I'm God and say, oh, let D be, you know, whatever it is, times two. And that would double this force. Right, so it sets the scale of the force. And you can keep that in mind when you learn about electromagnetism, because it really has the same form. You have a different constant here, and then you have a charge over R squared. So it's really the same force law, and it's different in a couple of different ways, but one of them is that constant actually has a different number. So in particular, what I want to talk about right now is when we have Earth as one mass, which I'll call ME, and we have something here, which I'll call M, small case m, and we ask, what is the gravitational force on that object that's fairly close to the center, to the surface of the Earth? So now this is a special case, which is, we've already sort of been talking about, so that's why I wanted to bring it up now. And in this case, the reason we say this is close to the center, close to the surface of the Earth, is that basically I want the difference, the distance above the center of the Earth here, to be small compared to the distance to the center of the Earth. So it's sort of irrelevant. So the radius of the Earth that we'll use, it can vary a little bit depending on where you are, but we're going to use 6.38 times 10 to the 6 meters. The constant G is, you know, creatively called the gravitational constant. And it's actually quite small. That is, gravitation is really a weak force, is a way to think about it. It's 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11 newton meter squared per kilogram squared. Why is that unit so weird? It's because this thing has to go right here, and you want newtons when you finish. This constant multiplies kilogram squared divided by meter squared. So in order to end up with newtons, I want to have this have units of newtons per meter squared divided by kilogram squared, so they all cancel out except for the newtons. And one of the masses we have to worry about is the mass of the Earth, which has been determined to be about 5.97 times 10 to the 24 kilograms, so it's pretty big. And now, if we have this problem, really, that we've been talking about, I shall transform my Earth here into something a little more Earth-like. Have a little mass here. Here's the center of the Earth. Here is the radius of the Earth. And the difference between where that mass is and this radius is very small. So we're going to ignore it for the moment. In that case, we take the equation that we just had, that F is equal to G M1 M2 over R squared, and it becomes G times the mass of the Earth times the mass of the object, whatever it is, divided by the radius of the Earth squared. I'm not proving to you that you only need worry about all, you can consider the entire mass of the Earth to be concentrated at the point. We get there in a month or 6 weeks or something. We'll prove that, and I may not prove that particular thing, but we will use it a lot and get used to it in about a month. And so what I want you to note is that
this, can you see the yellow? Okay. This piece. Those are three constants. This one sets the scale for gravitation. You go out and measure it. Okay, given masses in kilograms and radii in meters, you measure this thing and you find what G is. There are ways to determine the mass of the Earth. It's a constant, I just gave it to you. The radius of the Earth is a constant, which means this number is just a constant. And note that this is the mass of whatever the object is that's near the surface of the Earth. Okay? We also know from Newton's second law that F is equal to ma. What that means is that this and that are the same. In fact, we define this quantity as little g, and it's 9.8 meters per second squared, which you can prove to yourself from those numbers that I gave you a moment ago up here. And this is what we call the acceleration due to gravity at the surface of the Earth. You okay with that? So, what we mean when we talk about weight and mass are different things. Mass, we've been talking about a kilogram. If you hold a kilogram, you sort of know what you mean by a kilogram. You've probably done that in chemistry lab. Okay? But what you really usually know is sort of what it weighs. That's what makes it different. A kilogram, something the size of a kilogram of iron, if I used lead, right, it would actually be much heavier, even though it's the same size. We define weight as the magnitude of the force of gravity due to Earth's gravitational field, gravitational attraction, near the surface of the Earth. So this force is what you mean by weight. You can talk about weight in different contexts. You could imagine asking, what is your weight on the moon? Right. Weight is defined sort of the way that we just did a moment ago. So on the moon, for example, your weight is going to be equal to your mass, which doesn't care whether you're on the moon or not. Okay, that is quantified sort of by your mass. So I guess that doesn't make a lot of sense. But that doesn't change whether you're here or on the moon. But now, what is the gravitational force on you if you're on the surface of the moon, ignoring everything else out there? It's going to be GMM, where one of the M's is the mass of the moon, over the radius of the moon squared. And it turns out that if you calculate, put in those numbers, this is equal to m times about 1/6 what we think of as G. G is always this 9.8. That the little g is a constant that is reserved for the surface of the Earth. But we can talk about your weight on other bodies in terms of fractions of g, if you wish. Okay. And that 1/6 really boils it down to that is the difference between what you have on Earth for the mass of the Earth over r squared to what you would have on the Moon when you put a plug in the Moon numbers. You have 1/6 of what you found on the Earth. So you have a weight that will vary depending on where you are. Okay? But there's a real distinction in terms of mass and weight. In MKS system, weight is a force, and it's in units of newtons. In the English system, I think we talked about this in the English system, your unit of weight is the pound. But that's a force. So to get your mass, you actually have to divide that force by g in English units, which is 32 feet per second squared. And so when you do, you end up with a unit that we call a slug. Why a slug? I have no idea. We won't be doing anything or very little with this in this class, but just be aware of it. Okay? Alright, so let's start to get into the core of what we're going to do this term now. Most of this course, in some form or another, all of this course, in some form or another, boils down to, other than the vectors that we did, is going to be a study of Newton's three laws. And one of the things that I've discovered when you look at the work that some of the true great ones have done, like Newton or Einstein, when you actually look at what they did, it's usually sort of, well, duh. It's sort of intuitive once you see it. But it's phenomenal insight to sort of see it somehow, these big steps. And I think Newton's laws are the same way. Part of the issue with Newton's laws and coming up with them is some of it is a little bit counterintuitive. So let's go through why. So his first law, I hope you can read it, so maybe you can't tell. A body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. Okay. I will get this going in its state of motion, and it should persist in its state of motion. Except it doesn't. So Newton was wrong. We can all quit. Okay? This actually is really rather counterintuitive. If you're sliding your chest of drawers in your dorm room and you let go, it stops. It doesn't persist. If you're pushing a car, same thing. So what are we missing here? You take your chest of drawers and you go over to the ice rink and you put it on the ice rink and you start to push it and you let go, it just goes. Eventually it may stop, the trick is a body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. So what's happening is unless you are providing a force to overcome
the force of friction, which is working against the motion, you can't continue going. What happens on the ice is you manage to reduce the force of friction to such a small level that it's no longer present. But if you're just shoving this in your dorm room, you have a big net force that's moving, but the moment you stop pushing, it no longer can move because there's a force of friction that basically works against that motion. So I think it's a little bit of a hidden law in the sense that you have to think about what things are like when they truly have no other force on them. So you have to have sort of a case where you eliminate friction. We'll look at some examples of that next class. So that is the first law. The second law tells us that the acceleration of an object is proportional to the net force applied to it and inversely proportional to the mass of the object. Or the sum of the forces, the vector sum, right, is equal to the mass times the acceleration. So we've already talked about that a bit, I think, right? If I'm small and I get hit by something big with a big force, I will accelerate with a large acceleration in the direction of that force. And they add vectorially, so if I get hit with another force this way, I will accelerate, but it will be as the vector sum of these two things. If I'm much bigger, I accelerate less, because the force is equal to mass times the acceleration. So it's just this vectorial sum is very important. It actually ties in very much with this law of inertia, because what it says is that you will keep going in the same direction if the net force is zero. Your motion will stay. You will not change your direction at all. Conversely, if something changes in its direction or its speed or whatever, you know there is a net force on it. Okay? So you have to sort of keep that in mind. The third law is known as the law of action and reaction. And this is the one that can sometimes bite you because it's a bit strange. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. How many of you have shot a gun before? I'm not talking about a monkey. When you shoot a gun, one of the things you'll note is it has a recoil. Okay, and depending on the size of the gun, the recoil can be quite dramatic. So you're shooting, and when you pull the trigger, it pushes on you. Okay, and the bullet goes out. And the way it works is that inside the gun, you have this explosion, and there's a huge force on the bullet going out that way. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The bullet is pushing on the gun with an equal force. Okay? The gun weighs a lot more than the bullet, so its acceleration is small for that same force. But it's still enough of an acceleration equal and opposite. So it pushes back on you. Rockets go up because they blow gas out the back. Right, so they push the gas out, the gas pushes them up. It's the equal and opposite. I'm going to push against this thing, okay? Why is it I don't fall? It pushes back with an equal and opposite force. And that starts to be counterintuitive. Because you sort of have to invent that force. We call it the normal force, which is the force of this thing on my hand. Clearly, I'm pushing on it. But there is an equal and opposite force of it pushing back on me. Okay. So,
I think you'll find in time that that sort of starts to be the most subtle of Newton's three laws. Okay.
Now, one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that this law, we say, is the sum of the forces, is mass times acceleration. So that really is the second law. But this is a three-dimensional thing. So what this really means is that the force in the x is equal to the mass times the acceleration in the x. The sum of the forces in the y is equal to the mass times the acceleration in the y. And the sum of the forces in the z is equal to the mass times the acceleration in the z. This is some lecture from last year because I had a slide that I wanted to use, but I wasn't sure we were going to get this far. So, okay. All right. So a thing to keep in mind is that this is a very powerful equation. It's a three-dimensional equation. Because it's a vector equation, just like everything vectors, it actually corresponds to three different things. It corresponds to three different, basically, scalar equations, where you sum all the forces in the x to get the acceleration in the x, all the forces in the y to get y, all the forces in the z to get z, and they're all true simultaneously. You may have a problem that's a two-dimensional problem or something set up that way, but you don't have to worry about one of the dimensions, but you have to sort of start worrying about it from the start, just in case. Okay, so this is a very powerful equation, and in fact, here you begin to see maybe a sense of why we do vectors, because the notation is very compact. Okay, so having done this, what you want to do is to actually look at the acceleration, and if you have the acceleration, you can see if it's constant or not, which allows you to look at the motion in that dimension, right? And you can then solve for it and then recombine it into three different dimensions. So we're going to do what are called Newton's law problems. And we'll go through this next time, but basically there's going to be a prescription of sort of how you want to do it. And you don't want to get in the habit of really taking shortcuts. Because a lot of the times you're going to be studying a problem which might be as simple as, you know, a mass sliding up and down an inclined plane and another one being on the other side of the string, and you have a pulley here that rotates, you just ask, what happens? What's the motion? And you're going to have a lot of intuition about these problems. Okay? Sometimes you'll be right, and sometimes you'll be wrong. And the only way to make sure you get it right is to go through a sort of a detailed procedure of how to work out the problem. And then, after you work it out, you come back to your intuition and you think your way through the problem to make sure you're right. So we're going to sort of spend the next few classes on this kind of thing.
Have a good weekend.